2010s. The good doctor is set to pay a house call, and we'll join Dr. Rick Perea right here in studio momentarily, or he will join us on Denver Sports Station, your home for the best live and local coverage of the Broncos and the NFL. Sports Radio 104.3 The Fan. Oh, what a lineup of guests. Man, Seth Everett at the top of our program today, bringing us up to date on the long-term weather forecast, why and how the game came to be staged, as it will be starting next week in New York, New Jersey. Terrell Davis, Chad Brown, veterans of Super Bowls past, joining us at 9:30 and 10 o'clock this morning, respectively. And, of course, the legendary Woody Page. And now, our man, the good doctor, back in studio with us for a second straight week off his accurate forecast, even with reservations, the Broncos over the Patriots last week. Let's look back before we look forward a little bit. Last week, you came in here and you tilted slightly in Denver's direction, but you had, I would say, some serious reservations. You thought the play calling of McDaniels would be very, very sharp and a key to the game. You thought Brady psychologically was in a pretty good place in relation to Manning and the surroundings of this particular game. But, of course, they do play the game, and as it turned out, in your estimation, the play calling of McDaniels was uncharacteristic, not very good. The performance from Brady was uncharacteristic, not very good, specifically missing in that first throw there where it was a good call by McDaniels, completely fooled the Bronco defense, and there's Edelman, and the pass goes sailing over his head. And you call that the qualitative aspect of sport performance, which is why we can't predict outcomes.
Absolutely.
With 100% accuracy. We have to allow for the human factor.
That's that. That's it. Great depiction, Sandy. That was beautifully put. Yeah, you know, I often on this show talk about qualitative versus the quantitative. And often people predict games based on the quantitative assessment, the score, the numbers. But we never know what's going to happen in terms of human behavior, the qualitative aspect. Tom Brady did not play well for three quarters. And some people could, you know, assert that it was because of Denver's defense. But one thing that was very telling for me, Sandy, is their first play from scrimmage, their very first play from scrimmage in the first quarter, it was a 10-yard out, and he threw the ball really high. I mean, the kid had to climb a ladder to go get it. And that's a 10-yard out. That told me that he was pretty highly aroused, high levels of anxiety. He had the butterflies. The butterflies weren't flying in formation on that throw. And then when he missed a couple receivers that were wide open that could have changed the game, at least in terms of psychological momentum early, that told me a lot that he wasn't really on. Now, I want people to remember, these guys are human organisms, right? They're not machines. And that's the qualitative piece of sport that we can't predict. And until the guys show up and play, you cannot predict what's going to happen. And that's the piece that I always say be wary of, because Tom Brady wasn't on. Josh McDaniels, his play calling, when he didn't stay with the run. Denver stuffed it a few times, and he just
got away from it. Absolutely.
And if you're going to pound it, you got to be committed to pound it, and he didn't do that.
What about, I have to get your reaction to the whole Belichick business. Right after the game, classy, gracious in defeat, crediting the Denver coaches, mentioning Fox specifically, talking about what he said to Fox, which is uncharacteristic of Belichick following the game. Congratulations, you had the better team, great job, everything else. Wouldn't comment specifically on the Welker play, didn't say anything remotely critical about it. But then the next day, at their season-closing press conference, he goes off on Welker. Not by name, of course. Welker becomes the receiver. Belichick characterizes the play basically as a cheap shot, says it's one of the worst plays he's ever seen. The league completely disagrees with him, doesn't even fine, much less otherwise discipline Welker for the hit. I heard Patriot people at halftime in the press box complaining about the officiating. This is in the first half of the game. They became, I thought, in some way psychologically unhinged.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, in regards to Belichick, I mean, here's a guy that really has mastered the mental side of the game, in my opinion. He really, you know, that's a focal point for him. But here's what happened. You know, after the game, he puts on his social mask. I mean, he has to be, you know, socially acceptable the way he presents himself. But I suspect that on the plane ride home and when he got back, you know, into Foxborough, you know, it was like he was bombarded with, you know, an assertion that that was not a legal play or a cheat play, whatever you want to call it. And so, therefore, I think he was more willing at that point to call it, you know, a cheap or illegal play. And he says, we'll leave it up to the league. But I think he was.
It sounded like he just hated Wes Welker.
Yeah.
More than making a judgment on the play because he didn't have that view of the play after the game. But I mean, I'm being facetious here. But on the plane ride back, maybe he remembered, I really don't like Wes Welker
right.
very much.
Yeah, it was a social, you know, I mean, it's influenced by his relationship. There's no doubt about it. I mean, one of the great things about him being a great competitor is he's not a good loser. I mean, he's not gracious.
No, he is one of the worst losers.
He's not gracious in his losing. And you know, he probably would be the first to sit here and admit and say, yeah, I'm not good at it, and I don't pretend to be good at it. So I just think it was Belichick being Belichick. And, it, you know, that's part of what allures him, makes his allure so delicious and inviting, is that he's a very unpredictable guy at times, but at the same time, he's a very successful football coach.
Well, two coaches who can't stand each other, obviously Pete Carroll and Jim Harbaugh, and I guess Richard Sherman and Jim Harbaugh, though they were together at Stanford, player and coach, pretty obvious they don't care for each other. Michael Crabtree and Richard Sherman, both during the game and afterwards, particularly with Sherman on national TV, there's clearly a problem there. But the Seattle organization, as you point out, fascinating, isn't it?
Yes.
Very progressive.
Yes.
In spite of some of their issues in projecting their team temperament to the public, this is a very progressive organization, as you suggest, by NFL standards. Certainly when it comes to particularly the area of mental enhancement, what are you talking about?
Well, there, you know, Pete Carroll is a very open-minded guy. If you've ever met him, he really is open to alternative explanations to human performance. And that's a great position to take. You know, a lot of NFL coaches are a little weary of quote-unquote sports psychologists. They really are. And the mental
enhancement. Carroll's just the opposite.
He's the opposite. He's very open. You know, he has instituted what we call cognitive reframing yoga. And what that means is athletes will perform yoga while talking or reiterating positive mental thinking, positive reiterations. And it's really effective. You know, yoga is a great way to center yourself as an athlete, but when you add in the cognitive reframing, the mental reframing of positive affirmations, it can be really powerful. And there'd be a lot of coaches you approach in the NFL and say, hey, let's look at doing this to help mentally enhance your athletes so they can reach peak performance, and they would kind of look at you sideways when you talk about cognitive reframing yoga. Whereas Pete Carroll, he's very progressive, and he's open to these ideas, and I think it shows. His players seem to play very free and not tight, and I think that's part of because he has an open approach to mental enhancement.
Okay, explain Richard Sherman to us, if you could. And we have a few minutes here, then we'll break and come back, talk some more. But in connection with this organizational philosophy that Carroll and all the rest seem to embrace,
yes,
what to make of Richard Sherman? Is it just completely an idea based on letting him be who he is? Is there some calculation to it, both from the Seattle perspective and Sherman's own personal perspective? My amateurish theory, I'm sure, is that Richard Sherman did what he did right after the game last week without passing a value judgment on whether it was good or bad, with an enormous amount of thought being advanced prior to his doing that. In other words, it was calculated.
Yes, I mean, I think so, but here
I'm open for business. See me at the Super Bowl.
Right. And
this is just a preview of coming attractions.
Absolutely. But here's another thing, Sandy. You know, he's in a great story. Kid out of Compton, California.
Absolutely.
You know, had a 4.3 GPA in high school, goes to Stanford, graduates with a 3.94 GPA at Stanford. I mean, you know, you can regulate anxiety and arousal if you can get a 4.0 in high school, if you can get a 3.679 in college at Stanford. Okay, one of my best friends, Vaughn Williams, went to Stanford, mm-hmm. and my goodness, it's a tough school, undergrad. It's a tough school. And so for him to be able to perform like that in the classroom tells me a lot about his emotional ability, his ability to regulate emotions. So I think what you saw on the field was, yeah, it was calculated. But I think that also, here's another thing. When these reporters put microphones in front of players right after a game, they're highly aroused. They're, you know, they have certain levels of anxiety. I think that was just his true self in that competitive state. You know, football is a violent game, and it takes a high level of arousal to get pumped up and play. And so I think he was just showing who he is on the field. You know, some of us, we want him to be gladiators on the field, and then when we interview him, we want him to be, you know, calm and collected. But in this case, he was just displaying
his
true self.
Let's try to tighten the perspective, though. As Jason Whitlock pointed out the other day on ESPN, this was not exactly Martin Luther King, I Have a Dream, either. And I think in response to the criticism, he's being projected as a great force for advancement, whether it be in terms of how athletes present themselves because he is so intelligent, or even in terms of his social consciousness and all the deeds he's done for which he deserves enormous credit. This is potentially a very important figure in sports. And he, in some ways, lost an opportunity in that moment to reflect part of what he presents to the public. Anyway, we only saw the, I don't know, seamier side, but we saw the more expressive and unhinged side. Although, I don't think he's ever totally out of control. I have to believe he knows pretty much what he's doing at all times. And, of course, he's a great player. We've seen self-promoters at the Super Bowl before who really couldn't play a lick. He can play.
That's right.
That's the difference. Well, we'll come back and talk more about Seattle and contrast that with Denver and how these two teams may approach the Super Bowl in very different ways. On your home for the best live and local coverage, the Broncos and the NFL, Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio, 104.3 The Fan. On Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio 104.3 The Fan, your home for the best live and local coverage of the Broncos and the NFL. It's a Bud Light Football Friday here on The Fan. Bud Light, the official beer sponsor of the NFL. Here we go. Sandy Clef, Dr. Rick Perea in studio. How does the Super Bowl change the psychological approach to the game? My sense is that Denver and Seattle will take slightly different approaches
yes.
this week to this game. Their practice routines already over the last few days have been a little bit different. The Seahawks will be off tomorrow. Worked Wednesday. The Broncos were off Wednesday. Work today, tomorrow, and obviously they were out there on the field yesterday. But the psychological approach to the game, the temperaments of these two teams seem very different.
Yes, very different. And I think both coaches, what ultimately they're trying to do is focus on the things that are relevant. And we call that relevant cues versus irrelevant cues. And it's called attentional foci. And really what you try to do is when you're working with individual athletes or even teams is you want them to filter out the things that are relevant. You know, they're going to go to Super Bowl week, and there's going to be a lot of distractions. And so the players, it's going to be incumbent upon the coaches, the trainers, all the assistant coaches to really make it clear to the players, here's what's relevant, and they name them. They put them down on paper. Here's what's irrelevant. They name them. They put them down on paper. And educate the players what to filter out and what to focus on. And if you can do that, then it still comes down to just playing the game. Because, you know, aside from all the hoopla that surrounds the Super Bowl, which is amazing, it still comes down to playing 60 minutes of lining up and playing football schematically and in terms of emotional and physiological regulation.
John Fox was asked yesterday, what do you advise your players to do when it comes to dealing with the media over the next week? And he answered fairly directly, saying, respect the media for having a job to do, talk the game, and say nothing.
Yes.
But
yes.
I thought talk the game was speaking to your point.
Right.
Talk the game.
Right. And that, you know, one could make the argument that the interviews for players is an irrelevant cue. I mean, it's something that you have to do, but it's not something that really is going to go into helping you win the game or you know, not helping you, you know, helping you lose the game. So I think it's really important that the Fox and Carroll are make it so clear to their players, here's what we're there to do. It's a business trip. You know, it's much like Saban. Saban approaches it all the time. It's a business trip. We're there to do a job. And then, you know what? After we win, then that's when the celebration comes on.
We spoke of this earlier on. When you look at the way this Super Bowl is set up, you have New Jersey where all the football stuff takes place, and you have New York City where all the media stuff takes place. And rarely, if ever, shall the twain meet, so to speak, except for John Fox and Pete Carroll conducting a joint press conference in New York City on Friday morning. Otherwise, all the football activity is over in New Jersey on the other side of the Hudson, and all the media activity, Radio Row and the talk and all the, as Fox calls it, noise, that's over in New York City. If you're a coach or you're an organization, do you let the players who will be staying in hotels on the New Jersey side of the Hudson River, do you let them venture into New York, or do you shut them down and keep them over in New Jersey?
Shut them down. I mean, this
really?
Is, yes, it's a business trip. I mean, it is. It's, you know, this 2 weeks between, you know, the champion AFC Championship game and the Super Bowl is a long time. And the longer you have to let your mind wander, the longer you have to pay attention to irrelevant cues, it can take you away from being sharp and focused in the game. They're there to do a job. After the game is when, you know, if they want to go to New York and see Times Square and do all that stuff, that's when they do it. But no, we're here to do a job. We're here to accomplish a task. And that we've talked a lot on this show about task cohesion. Part of that is making sure that you take care of what you take care of, and that's preparation. Coaches have preparation. Players have preparation. And the mental part of that, Sandy, is vital to the game. Whoever approaches this game better mentally is going to win. Okay, I'll tell you that right now. Whoever approaches this game from a more balanced perspective, and I'll guarantee you, Seattle's going to be doing their yoga. They're going to do it there, and they're going to do it every day in the way they in their practice and protocols. Now, I'm not saying Denver doesn't do that stuff. I don't think they do, but I can tell you this. The more they can have it to a normal week of practice, mm-hmm. just like they are at home, the better performance will emerge.
Well said. We'll let you run on this real quick. The last time an NFL title was decided in New York City was some 51 years ago. The legendary Lombardi Packers matched against the Giants of Y.A. Tittle and Sam Huff. Classic game. Extreme cold and wind at Old Yankee Stadium. Packers win 16-7. After the game, Vince Lombardi says, "I think it was about as fine a football game as I have ever seen. I think we saw football as it should be played." All the conversation yes. about the weather,
right.
that Lombardi comment, very interesting.
Yeah, absolutely, because you look, football is played for the masses, and that's, you know, the large populations that love to see scoring and wide-open football. But true football aficionados, old-timers like me, we love weather being a factor. It takes, you know, coaches have to adjust game day to their game plan. Players have to adjust. Trainers have to adjust. I mean, different spikes are used on the shoes. So it's really an important piece or variable or factor to the outcome of a game. And that's how I was raised around football, that weather is part of the equation. And it's kind of sad for me to know that it's trying to be filtered out in modern day football.
Yeah, old traditionalists, I like it. Quick sense. I know the game is 8 days out, 9 days. Lean to Denver, lean to Seattle. Have any thoughts?
I can change them. Okay.
are your thoughts on
I think psychologically, I think Peyton Manning is going to be a hard guy to beat.
Yes.
But if there's turnovers, that's the great equalizer.
The great equalizer.
So, yeah, I think I'm going to go with Denver, Peyton Manning, Denver by two.
All right. And Peter King, Sports Illustrated, says Denver by three. So, Denver, the favorite after being for months an underdog. Very interesting. A lot more to talk about. We'll have plenty of coverage next week, morning, noon, and night, all day long, Monday through Friday. We look forward to that. We'll talk to you next on Monday morning from Radio Row in Times Square as we get ready for Super Bowl 48 between the Broncos and Seahawks. Sandy Clough advising you to stay where you are right now. Bruin Scott are standing by the drive with Big Al and D-Mac from 3 to 6. On your home for the best live and local coverage of the Broncos and the NFL, Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio 104.3.